This is the Senate Committee on Labor, Consumer, and Business Affairs, meeting in Hearing Room B at 1 o'clock p.m. on Monday, May the 9th, 1977.
We have the marked-up copy of Senate Bill 884 on its own work session, and the amendments are all included in the bill. It's a short bill. If you want, the committee wants to take a look at it. It has a subsequent referral for Ways and Means.
So ready to go?
Ready to go.
Where's the markup?
The markup, you have the amendments. The amendments are on the top, which were adopted previously. These incorporate both the horse racing and dog racing amendments, and then the bill as marked up are the second and third pages.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
We're on the thin edge of a quorum. Would the a motion to wipe out the dog amendments meet with the chair's support?
I feel it would be discriminatory. I would hope that it would go out the way it is.
You wouldn't want me to discriminate against dogs?
No.
Greyhounds, I think I would go on this.
I've gone to the dogs in my lifetime.
Okay. I'll move the bill out to Ways and Means, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Senator Strong moves Senate Bill 884 to with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carson?
Aye.
Senator Drumstead?
Aye.
Senator Trill?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Let's go to Senate Bill 944. Who's been working on that?
We have.
I work so hard.
What kind of a job have I got?
These are a couple extra.
Oh, I see.
There are a few bills.
Oh, I see.
You want to go over the amendments, Rich? Is Bill Doss here? No.
To trace the history on this bill, we originally had a hearing on April 11th, at which time extensive amendments were proposed by the sponsor, Senator Attia. Those were incorporated into the A engrossed version, so you should make sure that you have the A engrossed Senate Bill 944 that you're looking at. It should be in your book.
These amendments.
No. Then the amendments that were just passed out here, dated May 5, 77, take care of the objections and comments that were presented on May 2nd.
Whose objections?
Mine. I think that helps.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right.
I think your objection, as I recall, is to have access to a firearm.
Yes, if you recall, the person was guilty of a crime if he was an armed security service and didn't have his permit but had access to a firearm. He was guilty of a crime, and the firearm might have been back in his dresser drawer, but that's having access to, and that was not what was intended. I think.
Are you satisfied with this amendment here, Senator Carson?
I believe so, Mr. Chairman.
It would now read, this is referring to on page 5, line 2, after firearm, you insert in the performance of the security service, which limits it to that particular thing. Line three, delete the comma, wear or carry or have access to a firearm is deleted there. And basically, these conform to that original amendment in line two. And on page 16, this is, these are basically inserted here at the request of the Department of Commerce to conform to the way that it will actually be done. In other words, the Director of Commerce will be doing the appointing of the board. And these are, all these amendments basically conform again to that things, chairman, the chairperson, and so forth. Section 32,
page
16. I want to
see. Section 32.
Delete the first five lines on page 20. And this
page 20. That page 20.
Are you looking at A and Grove?
No.
Here.
Sorry.
A new section here on all fees and other funds received by the board under this act shall be paid into the Commerce Administration account. The payments shall be credited to a separate subaccount and are continuously appropriated for the purpose of administering this act. And then we make a new 33A, which is inserted after line 13. That you can read here on pages, the last two lines of page two of the proposed amendments and all of page three. And through four. And then there's other last changes on pages four and five of the amendments, again, conform to that earlier change in regard to the Director of Commerce instead of the board.
Move the amendments, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Crowe moves adoption of the amendments. Are there any objections? Hearing none, it is so ordered. What's your pleasure with the bill?
I'll move it out.
Senator Carson moves Senate Bill 944 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carson?
Aye.
Senator Drumstad?
Aye.
As amended, right.
Right.
Okay.
Senator Cho?
Aye.
Senator Wire, Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Let's go to, let's see, where's the sign-up list here? 791. We have a 100 witnesses here.
Go to this one, the Ways and Means. We just go to this one to the floor.
435. We have a lot of witnesses.
200. 791. 790. Are you taking 791 first?
Yeah, I don't know. Let's take Senate Bill 435 first. We've had one hearing on first. We've had one hearing on this already, and see if we can do anything with that. Senate Bill 435. I'm going to ask that if there's anyone that's signed up on 435, we have a number of bills to hear. If they could limit their testimony. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 2, 4, 6, 7, 4, and 1, 2, 3, 4 against. Now, I'm sure the committee is, we know that the numbers are here, but I'm sure that we're going to listen to the facts and base our decision on the facts. So if there are any of you here that feel that there that would be a duplication of testimony if you were to testify, we'd appreciate it if you'd just say you agree with so-and-so and not take up the committee's time as well as your own. Our first witness will call on Richard Kyrus, the Lynn Benton Lincoln Labor Council. Tell us what, USWA, that's...
That's United Steelworkers of America.
Okay, yeah.
Put that microphone close to you, sir.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, my name is Richard Kyrus. I am the president of the Lynn Benton Lincoln Labor Council, representing organized labor from the Tri-Counties. It takes in about 3,500 members right at the present time. I'm also employed at Teledyne Wachang, Albany. I am the grievance committee chairman for that local union, and some of my discussion this morning, or this afternoon rather, will be based on direct involvement with problems that we do have in that plant. I'd like to start out by saying that with somewhere around 10% unemployment in the state of Oregon today, we feel that it's disgracefully disgusting that forced overtime has to be a subject here. This is something that I feel it should have came to legislature a long time ago. In fact, it was that I was told back in, I think, in 1856, there was a law on the books stating the fact that it was unlawful to work a man more than 10 hours a day at that time, period. I'd like to point out just a few points and try to be as brief as I can. I just want to say that the unemployment in our area, Wachang is one of the bigger industries and companies doing hiring. We have some 1,700 employees at Wachang, which each month we receive on an average 600 applications for employment alone at that plant. Out of the 600 applications, we average somewhere around one dozen people employed each month. That's a great number of people seeking employment versus a small number of people that are actually employed each month. The reason for this number being so small that are employed is that basically represents the turnover that we have there at that plant. It appears to me that in the Tri-Counties of Lynn, Benton, and Lincoln, that basically speaking, Lynn County and Lincoln County got the highest unemployment percentage accordingly, but it's kind of a basic rule that unemployment follows employment, and where the most employment is, you'll find the most unemployment also. So that there is one point I'd like to bring up, too, that concerns me. One of the greatest things that I want to speak on is the safety and health problems that we have. Everybody in the state of Oregon knows that Wachang has problems with the DEQ and renewing their DEQ permits. I want everybody to know and understand that DEQ permits only are standards and that are handed down to the companies only pertains to outside the plant premises. DEQ controls nothing on the inside of the plant. Also, I'd like to just make out one little thing here to let you understand what the DEQ permits are, is that they take a running average, so to speak. Whenever they check it out, it's not, they don't just point out the high points and the low points. They take the whole average, so you have high peaks and low peaks. At the end of the testing and what have you, they say, okay, you can have a certain percentage of emission and discharges, but they can't exceed a certain percentage over a period of time. I want you to know that we do have very high points that occur, and we have employees working in these conditions at the time that they do occur, and they're very harmful. You have to wear full face respirators, and Scott air packs and such as this just to work in certain areas in that plant. And these are the main areas that our forced overtime occurs in. I think it's bad enough to work in these areas and try to make a livelihood for your family and make the best life you can 8 hours a day, let alone be forced to work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week in this type of circumstances. I know that I've been told that by company officials at our plant that forced overtime is really no concern of ours, and that they got completely upset when they found out that we were testifying, giving testimony on this type of thing. They said it's basically a bargaining issue that should be bargained for, but I'm here in behalf of all of laboring people in the Tri-Counties, not just the organized people. I want you to understand that.
Have you ever attempted to bargain this issue with your employer? Has it ever been a bargaining session with your employer there as far as as far as the worker concerned?
We have bargained to the fact before, but it's just like any other bargaining. You go in and sit down at the table and you say, we don't want any forced overtime. The company then returns says, we want all forced overtime. So now you have to start giving and taking to get anything, or else you just, close the plant down. Everybody knows, all the employees that work out there and belong to the union at that plant realize which side the bread is buttered on. This is one issue that is always being brought to our attention by management. They say, you have to realize we have a railroad to run. And we can't run the railroad without manpower. We keep stressing to them that, again, I'd like to point out that I'm basically familiar with my own plant, so I'll give you examples from that plant. We have some 1,200 union employees at Wachang, and I would, just off the top of my head, say 50% of those employees want to work overtime. They have to work overtime. They rely on overtime to pay bills. There are fat people down at that plant working. There's no doubt about it. the company knows this, and this is one of the main issues in negotiations why we haven't got as far as we should get, is because we defeat our own purpose because of our own people wanting to work overtime, some of them. 50% of the people do not want to work any overtime, though. They don't have to work overtime to live. They don't rely on overtime for any of their livelihood. And this is how come all laboring people run into a headwind when they try to negotiate overtime, forced overtime issues. Because you got 50% of the people that want to work overtime and have to work the overtime. You have 50% that don't want to work the overtime. You haven't got the majority of the people on either one side.
That's a frequent problem in politics, too. Could I ask a question?
Sure.
About half on each side, both sides mad at the other. But what you say you're here representing the working people in all three counties. Could you give us a little more detail on that and how it is that it was decided, particularly in Wah-Chang, to authorize you to speak in favor of this bill? I'm not asking you that to challenge you. I'm just curious to inform myself on how the decision-making is done on this and so forth.
He's an official of the union.
Yeah. Yes, I understand that, but he says that a lot of people there, about half want it, about half don't, and he's taking quite a strong position, and I'm not trying to question
back my theory up is because we're just now, at this time, entering negotiations for our local agreement with the company, and this is what I find through consensus, through the employees there, that we do have people on both sides of the fence in our own union, employees. Some of them argue the point, we want more overtime, we want more money for overtime. Where the other half say, we don't want any overtime at all. And this is what I base that theory on.
Wouldn't half the employees be enough employees to take care of all the overtime there without having to get those that don't want to work overtime?
That's one of my main points that I would like to bring up.
Okay.
With this situation being this way, we have brought this to the attention of the company several times. In fact, many, many times. Because we do have discipline at that plant also. And I have several suspension letters and several white slips that have been issued to employees who made a point to let the company know that they weren't interested in overtime on a certain weekend or overtime period. The company, knowing well that they do have the manpower that they could put a little time and effort into to train and familiarize the employee with a certain job, and they could get the coverage without forcing anybody to work. But that's time-consuming, and when you deal with large corporate organizations such as Teledyne, it seems on an assumption that they really don't care about you as an individual. They care about profits, and that's basically what they care about. So how they get those profits and the easiest way to get them without spending the least amount of money, this is what they're shooting for. And this is where we run into problems. When you have five people, two people are trained to do a job, you have five people that are available, three people aren't trained, the company is very reluctant to train the other three people to do the job that want to work. They force the people that don't want to work that are trained on these jobs. And this is one of the solutions that we've tried to get the company's attention on, and they refuse to bargain in these here lines. That they don't want to go to any added expense to train any extra help or train people that's already employed to do certain functions when they already have somebody trained and all they have to do is force them to work. I'd like to point out one more factor involved in our plant down there is that if you know anything about Wah-Chang, you'd know that it has one of the highest accident rates in the whole United States. as far as an industrial company. Mm-hmm. This is one of the big issues that we're run up against down there, is that the company itself has been instructed from corporate headquarters in L.A. that lost time accidents will be chopped down. Now, to do this, they're doing it on paper, but paper only. We have a very high accident record. We have our own emergency crews, we have our own ambulance, we have our own doctor even, we have our nurse, we have everything. But yet, we still continually have accidents,
you
and this is one of the things.
Working conditions are unsafe at Teledyne?
Very much so. I feel that basically this is one of the reasons why, is because there isn't one day that goes by at Teledyne Huachang that somebody isn't forced to work overtime. There's not one day that somebody isn't forced to work overtime.
Let me ask you this. You're a union official. Certainly, if you'd call OSHA, you know the procedure. Your name is not disclosed. You can call OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Act, the Accident Prevention Division, if there is unsafe conditions there, and notify them. They'll have inspectors down there immediately, unannounced. And
I'd like to comment on that, too.
You should be doing this.
I'd like to comment on that, too.
Okay.
We have contacted OSHA. We've also contacted NIOSH. We've also contacted everybody that we can contact, and nobody seems to listen to us. We had OSHA down at our plant for a period of 3 weeks straight here the other day. They had a full team working round the clock. There was 9 people from OSHA in our plant here a while back. They would not allow us as a union to go around with them on their inspections and on their testing.
You have a right to. They have a right to have a union.
We brought this out to them. We were denied this right. I met with the man, the main man himself, and we sat down at the table, and he explained to me that basically he would tell us where they was going to be and what testing they was going to do and where they were going to be at, and then we could question him after they took the test, but he didn't need anybody standing there babysitting him while he was doing it. He knew the testing. He knew what they was going to do. He also agreed, which was not met, that he would sit down with the union and go over any testing that we wish for them to go over and do it any way we wanted it done. This was not done. As soon as they got through with their testing, they ignored us, left the plant, and we haven't seen them since. We have filed charges with the federal agencies against the state agencies. We are consistently in problems with this here same type of deal. We call up the state and turn in an official complaint, and we don't get any compliance from the state. We've also called up the state to turn in an official complaint on problems, and the company knows 3 days ahead of time before the state people come in that they're coming in, and they put up a memo stating the fact that the state will be in here on Thursday, and this is only Tuesday, will be here Thursday. Everybody shut their jobs down and clean the place up.
Can you give me evidence of that?
Yes, I can.
This is in violation of the law, and they'd be subject to a fine, OSHA, the inspectors, if that is...
This is one of the complaints that I called the federal agencies in Portland and complained about this, and they said, well, we're sure that it couldn't be coming from within the state group. This is just one of the problems. This isn't really, this is getting off the subject of the forced overtime, but...
It's something to do with a forced overtime, if you feel it causes accidents because you are required to work overtime.
Just one more question in that area. What is OSHA? Do you contend to OSHA that people being there that are tired because they work so much overtime is a safety hazard? And do you contend that to Teledyne? And what's their answer to that? And is that one of your contentions?
Yes, I have a grievance filed right now. It's pending four-step hearing at this date, and I'd like to just give you a little background on it. Had in this here area, the San Clemente area, is It's a real hole, I'll tell you that. You have to work in the place, you have to wear a full-face respirator. I mean, it goes completely over your face, eyes, mouth, what have you, and you have an air box on the side of you. On a voluntary basis, we'll admit that it was on a voluntary basis. One young man volunteered to work 12-hour shifts for the full week, 5 days. He worked 2 12-hour shifts, and on the third 12-hour shift, he came to the foreman and explained to his foreman that he had bit off more than he could chew and that if he needed a rest. He was having some other personal problems. He needed a rest. He couldn't put in a 12-hour shift. He wasn't getting enough sleep. And he was too tired to continue completely through. He needed a rest for this one day, and then he would continue the rest of the week on the 12-hour shift, but it was just run down, and he couldn't continue. At that time, the foreman instructed him that since he had volunteered for it, that meant that his schedule had been changed, and now he had to come in and he had to continue the shift. The young man went home after 8 hours into the shift. He put in 8 hours. He went home after 8 hours. He was issued discipline for this. He came back the following day and continued the 12-hour shift, but we grieve the discipline on this here. It was brought to the company's attention. They had deaf ears when we pleaded with the company that the man was absolutely physically drained, that he needed some rest. And if these here are the type of problems that I wish to point out to you that become accident hazards. Now,
do you have any kind of a safety committee that could do a post-mortem and see what percentage of the people that had injuries were working more than they were working excess hours?
We have a safety committee, and we probably can get to that probably, but our safety committee, we have run into a lot of headwind on that also by the company. I'd like to just, for instance, explain to you one time when a person was issued discipline for not working forced overtime. We have several departments in our plant. One department is called extrusion, and they have several occasions here recently just put up a work schedule on Thursday stating the fact that they have issued a 36-hour notice and they have changed your work schedule. Now you will work the weekend. And no ifs, ands, and buts about it. On this here particular time, we have challenged this several times, but on this here one particular case in mind, the employee's name and the job that he normally works was stated on the memo itself that was posted. When he came to work, he was told that he wasn't to perform his normal functions, that he was supposed to go over and perform other functions. And immediately he protested against this here. He questioned the assignment. He said, look, I can see the company's point in forcing a person to work when it's an emergency and you have to have it done. But when you're forced to work and it's not even on the same job that you normally perform, he says this should be the discretion of the employee and he should have a choice. The employee went home, refused to work, and he was issued a 10-day suspension without pay. And this is one point I'd like to make. A 10-day suspension without pay.
You've given a number of examples. We've got quite a few lined up. When we've heard examples, we've heard a number of opponents before, and I'm not trying to cut you off.
Okay,
fine. But we don't have much time, and we're real short, and we have another bill to be heard.
I'd like to see you after this meeting when we're through, if I may talk to you.
Okay, I'd just like to close by saying there's two things. It's basically what I haven't said. One, forced overtime forces you into a higher tax bracket. That's one thing, to work and earn money and get into a higher tax bracket on your own choice, but to be forced into a higher tax bracket, it should be your own choice. One last thing. I am here as the president of the Lynn Benton Lincoln Labor Council, and I am very much concerned about unorganized labor. They have no choice. They have nobody but you people to throw their mercy on. And without your help, they have no chance at all in bargaining anything. They either work it or they are handed the death penalty on their jobs.
Thank you very much. I would hope that the United Steelworkers are a very fine local. I would hope that they would be able to negotiate something such as this, but evidently it's impossible.
Well, we've gained a lot of headway. We still, I can show you, we have a lot of problems, but we have come a long ways.
What I'm afraid is going to happen is that all of the union's locals are going to be down here on every matter that they can't negotiate, asking the legislature to take some action.
I agree with you 100%. This can be negotiated, only you just can't get from here to here in one giant step. It takes a number of negotiations, and we have three-year contracts. And to get from absolutely zero to 100%, no forced overtime, it's going to take a number of years, and in that meantime, we're going to have a lot of people that are injured, we're going to have a lot of heart attacks, we're going to have a lot of problems in that meantime. And we can do it, but we need your help to get there faster. Okay. It's unorganized labor that needs your help absolutely 100%. They have no choice.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Carras. Now, we have a number of witnesses. I would appreciate if we could, if there are someone, there are those in favor of it, Mike Elmore, Greg Moore, Wayne Anderson, Mike Morris, Bill Wilson, and James Phillips. And then there are a number. I'd like to take two more of those that feel that they're spokesmen. And we have had a hearing, and most of the proponents of this bill have spoken at the last meeting. So there is, we've heard about the problems of CWA, the forced work. Is there anyone here that feels they are a spokesman, and or those that want to delegate someone as a spokesman, and if they can offer something new, because we have had one hearing, an extensive hearing on this particular bill. Would you like to come up and give your name? We're going to have two more, and then we're going to have three from opponents, out of the opponents, and we're going to ask the opponents if they would like to have someone. Yes. You give them to the girl over there. Would you give your name for the record and whom you represent?
My name is Greg Moore. United Steelworkers of America. Thank you. Local 5074.
Now, we have all these insubordination, these charges, and we can read those, so you don't have to, it's not necessary, and I see there's numerous ones.
Okay.
Here, and if you can make your remarks as brief as possible and to the point.
Okay, I work as an electrician at Hannah Nichols Smelting Company in Riddle, Oregon. I am here in favor of Senate Bill 435. I am a past grievance chairman and know the problem with overtime. Our plant runs 24 hours a day and 7 days a week with crews that relieve each other. And if employees do not show up for work, someone has to be called out or work over. Other crews work only days and swing and maintain the plant and try to keep it running. I brought with me some written warnings that were given to employees. The names are on them and everything. These employees were called.
Excuse me, could you direct your voice more into the microphone, please?
These employees were called out on an overtime shift to clean off wobblers. These wobblers are, it's a mechanism that ore runs over, where the small parts fall through and the bigger parts go over to a crusher. These men would clean these wobblers off, and then the foreman would start up the machine, and they'd be filled again, and they'd have to clean them up again. This went on all night, till 7 in the morning. This was a graveyard shift. At 7 in the morning, the wobblers were still dirty, so the foreman told the men they had to stay over, clean it off, which he claims would be an hour. Well, they were fed up, so they went home. That's why they got the written warning. Later, we resolved these warnings, took them out of their records, only because we proved that the foreman had been drinking. Otherwise, they probably would have still stood. The others are some people that were called out on a day off shift, and they refused to come out, so they were all suspended for 3 days. Later, these were resolved, and the people didn't get suspended because they were scheduled to work as laborers. The company could not schedule them to work as laborers. They were not laborers. Another one of my exhibits there is a copy of our proposals and the company's proposals in our last negotiation to show you that we proposed no mandatory overtime. They proposed mandatory overtime.
Is this one of the graffiti on it?
That's my notes that I kept. It's a good copy. That's the exact answer they gave us when we asked for it. That's what I wrote there.
Did you
notice? I've shortened this quite a bit. I can't read my notes, so I guess all I can do is ask you people for your support and your help, because I think we need something to be done.
Appreciate it, Mr. Moore. I see that you've tried to negotiate overtime and are this overtime on a voluntary basis, and you've been unsuccessful.
Right. I think if to get it at that plant, I think we will have to strike. And nobody likes to strike, but maybe we'll have to do it. It is a big problem.
Is there anyone representing your company here today? I don't see anyone.
I don't know.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Are any further questions? If not, thank you. Okay, we have one more that's from the ranks of labor. Do you?
Mr. Chairman, Senators, my name is Wayne Anderson. I'm a staff representative for the United Steelworkers of America. I'll try to be brief in my remarks, really as a follow-up to Mr. Moore's previous testimony on the amount of overtime that has worked. We would like to take a position really that this is more towards full employment than a bargaining position. The examples here with Hanna Mining Company in the first 2 months of this year, January and February, our officers show that there have been 18,243 hours of overtime work. This is shared among 453 employees. This comes to really about an average of 1 hour per day per employee. We feel it's much more far-reaching than that. In Douglas County, we have a very high rate of unemployment, 11.3%. There's a total of 4,080 unemployed people in that area. If we could utilize additional employees to offset the amount of overtime that is worked, we would be able to increase the workforce for Hanna by 12% or an additional 55 employees. This would reduce the number of unemployed by 1.3%, which we feel is a very high figure and something that is a must if the state and the economy is to continue and improve. Hanna employs about 1.4% of the employees within Douglas County. If the same application could be applied throughout the other areas, the other plants that are there, I'm sure, that instead of having a problem of showing unemployment, we would have a problem of seeking employees. As to an argument that the additional benefits would be prohibitive or prohibit the cost of additional employees, the premium pay alone for these hours amounted to around $60,000. And I'm sure that no fringe benefits are amounting to equal of one half of the straight time out of the earning. Fringe benefits are high, admitted, yes, but not to that extent. Hanna is not the only plant that we do have problems with. All of them have a number of problems, all of our plants throughout the state. The staff spends numerous hours in grievances and arbitration proceedings to protect the rights of the employees. And this, a lot of it, we base on the existing statute, which states that it's the public policy of the state that no person shall be hired for longer hours or days of service and is consistent with his health and physical well-being. We feel that the individuals themselves are the best qualified to determine what their health and well-being is. Repeated overtime certainly has a very high impact on the individual's health, his well-being, the problems that are caused and created at home. Much of this could be resolved to a straight 8-hour shift. We had a grievance filed by an individual also in Riddle, an employee of Lone Star Industries, where he had been working 6 10-hour days a week for a number of months. He had recently been married. His wife was from out of state, back in the Midwest, some area, I don't recall. And he'd informed his foreman that he did not want to work overtime this one weekend. His reply was that he would, that his wife was a big girl now and she could take care of herself. We don't feel that this is a proper attitude to take. We must give some consideration to the individuals in our home life in order for them to even be a productive employee within the plant. As Mr. Kyrus had stated, we're not speaking only for those within our union. We're speaking for all laboring people within the state. Organized labor represents approximately 25% of the employees in the state. Somebody must speak for these other employees as well. And we as a steel workers are speaking for them. We request that you do support and pass Senate Bill 435.
Okay, are there any questions? If not, thank you. Yes, Senator Roberts.
Are there a lot of examples of employers who have not given the employee even a notice of the fact they would have to work overtime that particular day or evening, and has not allowed the employee to make arrangements necessary for child care or changing other obligations, and that when that employee is then refused,
There are numerous cases. I couldn't cite them specifically. Our representatives from the local unions and the grievance committeemen within those units would have that documentation. I'm sure that if we wanted it, it could be secured.
Okay.
But there are numerous cases where this does happen, yes. We have attempted in many of the plants to negotiate a voluntary overtime. Here again, if this is done, it does come to a strike situation. The only other way that we could get into an elimination would be by negotiating a penalty or an overtime premium that would be high enough to discourage the employment on overtime. Yet if our demands were adjusted to that, the first thing we would hear is that the union's position is inflationary. We would have the public, the state, and everybody else down on us because of it. So we have no other recourse to come. We are here asking the support on it.
Do you feel that you will be disciplined, you or any of your colleagues will be disciplined by the company or an attempted discipline because you appeared before this committee?
As far as myself, no, sir, because I am on staff. The local unions, from some of those, I would say that there would be a possibility, yes, because they are directly involved with their employer, and I am not.
Yeah. Senator Wires, I believe, had a question.
Yeah, just one. She's not done on it.
Are you aren't through yet? Or
well, I was just going to follow up on your
okay,
question.
Okay, go ahead.
Mine's on something else.
Okay, I was just going to request that if in your company there is apparent harassment or penalties on employees that came down here to testify, we would like to certainly hear of those actions because it would certainly affect our judgment about the necessity for this kind of legislation.
We would certainly inform you. Incidentally, one rather ironic, in the last hearing we had, Mr. Vern Bergevin, the president of Local 6163, was here and testified for the steelworkers at Wacheng at that time. He was unprepared. He had stated at that time that another individual was to appear. However, that individual was unable to appear because he was being forced to work overtime.
Yep, I recall that.
Yes.
Probably deliberate.
One quickie, Mr. Chairman. You were saying that it's the inflationary argument is leveled at you, but you mentioned the when people work a lot of hours, they aren't at home. Would you make the argument that it's inflationary to have people not spending very much time with their families? I'm trying to feed you a line. Having been a juvenile officer, I found that people who weren't exceedingly poor and unemployed, who had children who were delinquent, were often people who were so busy out working, chasing the buck, that no one was ever at home to watch and set the limits for their teenage children, who then ended up off doing whatever their inventive minds came up with, and which ended up costing property damage and salaries for police and juvenile officers and so on.
It's unfortunate, but I do assume that there would be a number that would be involved in it that way, yes.
What he's asking, are there more juvenile delinquents among children of steel workers than there are other?
That I couldn't reply to.
Okay, any further questions? If not, thank you very much. Now we're going to three from management. And we have and we also would like to have, we have the farm interest here, industry. We have signed up Phil Galay with the Oregon Farm Bureau, Michael McLean with Curly's Dairy, Mike Dewey with the Oregon Wheat Growers League, and Jim Mitchum, NECA, Jack Kalinowski, AGC, and Jim Falstrom of Boise Cascade. I'd ask Jim Falstrom, we can talk to Jack Kalinowski or Jim Mitchum anytime. And Mike Dewey, too. So let's have Jim Falstrom, and then it'll be followed by Michael McLean and Phil Galay. You want to talk? Well, we'll turn that over to Mike Dewey then. Okay? Mr. Falstrom?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Jim Falstrom. I'm the resident manager of the Boise Cascade Paper Mill in Salem. We are very concerned over the possible passage of Senate Bill 435 for the following reasons. Our labor agreement, which is with Local 467, of the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers, has a number of provisions which actually force us to schedule overtime, which could be avoided. For example, our labor agreement contains a very specific procedure we must follow in order to replace employees for any reason during a week. Unless we have a qualified extra employee on the same shift, we must offer 16-hour or 12-hour shifts to specific employees. The agreement does not allow us to change schedules during a week so that such vacancies can be filled by employees working on a straight time basis. Sure. Like all pulp and paper operations, Salem Mill must be operated continuously in order to be profitable. To jeopardize our ability to run continuously by giving our employees the right to contractually dictate how overtime is to be filled, and then the right to refuse that overtime, would be totally unworkable.
Would there be enough people that would be glad to get overtime? We heard testimony that 50% of the employees were happy to get overtime. Wouldn't you have that number of people? You wouldn't have to force overtime on someone that didn't want to work overtime?
I think in some cases that would be true. I think in other cases it would be not true. And I think there would be many instances where we would not be able to get a volunteer for overtime.
Senator Wires, you had a question there, now that we have this interruption.
Well, I got a new one now. Wouldn't it be, don't you think it would be more, it might serve the public better to hire the additional people it would require to get the job done without so much overtime, and pass the cost on to the consumer, and have fewer people out of work, and so we have fewer people tearing the hell out of the rest of us.
Senator, one of the problems we have there, and I think there are several associated with that, is that what you're really talking about is scheduling extra people on each shift and basically in each department. And then when everybody shows up for work, there you are with 3, 4, 6, or 8 extra people on that shift and no work for them. And also contractually, if we bring people into work, why then we're obligated to pay them minimum, I believe it's 4 hours now. So cost-wise, it would be a very...
Give a number of hours of work you want to get done and give a number of people. It would seem to me you could schedule it in a way that would work out. Having scheduled employees myself before, I found those things can be worked out. You mentioned contractually as though that's forced upon you by the workers.
Yes, sir. It's a contractual obligation in our labor agreement.
The prior witness indicated that their employer forced on them. They said that contractually they had the contract shoved down their throat by the employer. Now you seem to feel that the employees are...
I'm not sure who the previous witness was speaking for. This I'm speaking now for the... basically for the pulp and paper industry and for Boise Cascade in particular.
Incidentally, we haven't had any complaints from the pulp and sulfite industry. To my knowledge, this committee has had no one testify in favor of this bill from your industry, thus far, employees of your industry.
No more questions.
You want to finish your, do you have one more question?
No, okay. I don't.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let's allow him to finish his testimony first. Yeah.
Some obvious results would be operational curtailments and hazardous working conditions due to improper manning. With an hourly workforce of 525 employees, we are faced with a large number of situations which force us to work overtime. We have 2,200 floating holidays per year, of which approximately 1,100 cause overtime. If all of these 1,100 are filled by split shifts, we then have 2,200 12-hour shifts required. We have approximately 1,000 unscheduled vacancies per year caused by illness or other personal reasons. We have jury duty, funeral leaves, maintenance overtime due to equipment breakdowns or extended repairs can easily add another 1,000 overtime causes. In total, there are over 3,000 instances each year that cause us to work people overtime. Overtime is expensive, and we critically examine our overtime costs and strive to reduce them. Due to the continuous nature of our operations, we must keep the jobs manned. Senate Bill 435 would have a very injurious impact on the Salem Mill.
Thank you, Mr. Folsom. I think Senator Roberts had a question here first.
How many hours of overtime are required per month at your plant?
You're speaking, Senator, in a year or
no.
Month
well,
or what?
All per year, but I'd like to see if you have a monthly breakdown.
I don't have an exact breakdown. I'm sure I could get that for you. I could also... Our overtime, for example, Sunday is an overtime day for everyone that works Sunday. So our overtime also is caused by the 7-day operation. But just for the overtime caused by people being absent and, you know, forcing us to work the whole people over or to call them in early to work that type of thing, I would estimate that if we have around 3,000 instances in a year, that probably each one of those would might average somewhere around 6 to 8 hours in duration. So you'd have a total there of, say, 18,000 overtime hours.
Yes. Any further questions?
Yeah.
Okay, Senator Roberts.
How many full-time employees would it require you to handle to hire if you were to make sure that you had those potential 18,000 hours covered?
Well, you can look at that two ways. One answer would be you'd have to hire about 9 people, but I don't think that's correct. In other words, if you figure that an average employee would work around 2,000 hours. The problem here, again, as I tried to express earlier, is that you cannot schedule these things. Some days you might have no one absent, and, in other words, no extra people required.
Okay, well, how many people do you have at the plant now?
525 hourly employees.
So you have 525 hourly
yes.
employees, and you're afraid this bill might require you to hire 9?
Senator, I'm afraid it would cause us to hire far more than that because, you see, you can't... Well, most of these jobs are skilled jobs. And you're trained in one department. You can't take 9 people and cover every opening in the mill.
Okay, now, we have a lot of... kinds of services or industries, occupations where substitutes are employed on a regular basis, and a lot of industries and services where there's a use of part-time employees. Do you use part-time employees?
No, we do not use any part-time employees, other than occasionally in a possibly a clerical situation.
Why is that?
Well, the seniority system within the paper mills is such that it makes it very difficult. You are actually working in a department on a progression ladder, and your rights are limited to that particular area or ladder. If you had an extra board person who was able to work in various departments, that's fine, but they don't have the skills to go into each and every one of those departments.
I'm trying to understand why there's no solution other than hiring a lot of different people who are not needed on a full-time basis. I'm trying to figure out why you can't use part-time. I'm still not satisfied. That if you're talking about a plant with 525 employees and I presume good management, that it's going to be impossible to find anybody who will voluntarily work overtime enough to pick up the slack, or why you can't hire an additional few people in those areas where there is an awful lot of overtime demand as a cushion for safety, to make sure that there is a coverage.
The overtime demand is pretty well spread among the various departments in the mill. It doesn't occur, all in one department or all in two departments.
Okay, one other question, Chairman. In Senate Bill 435 on page 3, in the last paragraph, it says that this section does not apply to persons employed in care and so forth in case of emergency where life and property are in imminent danger. When the safety of the employees are endangered by having a short crew in a particular area, that would seem to be a situation where it would be dangerous for that crew to continue with a short, with less than full coverage. Would you feel that this bill would require you to continue in that sort of situation with a short crew?
I think there are instances, say in our power house, our recovery boiler area, some of those places where it possibly might fall under that danger to life and property clause. I would assume there might be other areas of the mill that would not fall into that. I think our concern is that this bill seems to more or less paint all industry with the same brush, so to speak.
So you don't feel that this would protect
I don't know that it would. I don't know that it would.
Senator Crowe?
Now, I just want to focus in on the average worker at Boise Cascade. How many hours a day is he working just generally on the average?
Schedule of 8 hours.
Schedule of 8 hours. Yeah. How many additional hours does he work overtime on the average?
That would vary, again, somewhat by department. What we call tour workers, who are people who work all three shifts on a rotating schedule. I would estimate that most of them would work, if a straight 8-hour work week comes around to 40 hours, I suppose that most of them would work an average of maybe 45 to 46.
You're saying one extra hour per day. Do they work a
5-day week, a 6-day week,
they
or
work,
7-day week?
In most cases, a 5-day week.
A 5-day week. Now, are they required sometime to work an additional day as overtime?
On a tour operation, they every once a month, they work a 6-day week.
They work a 6-day
yes.
week. Do they ever work a 7-day week?
Not unless it's caused by absence of other employees.
But it can be. They can
be.
Work a 7-day
yes,
week,
can.
8, 9 hours a day.
Yes, they can, 8 hours. Right. Or they could also work 12 hours.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, they can work 16 hours.
Okay.
Those are limited by contract, however. To,
yeah.
You know,
but it could be that much, and it could be as much as a 6-day week or a 7-day week. And you could ask them to do that.
We could.
Yeah.
And we do sometimes. Some cases we have to.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Okay.
What if they refuse? Would you discipline these people? Say a man worked 16 hours. Would you do the same as his field workers and Riddle?
If a man has worked a double or 16-hour shift during a week, why, he can't be forced to work another one.
That's in your union contract?
Yes, sir.
Why couldn't the others have the same thing in their contract? You must be easy to negotiate with.
Well,
any further questions?
We are.
If not,
Chairman, one more question.
Senator Roberts.
You know of instances, not in your company, but in other companies, that are not covered by union contracts to protect the employees against this kind of overtime abuse. Do you know of problems that would indicate to us that we need a change in the law to help those employees that don't have a good union contract with, and a good understanding with their employers?
Senator, I've only worked in the paper industry, and I really can't speak for, you know, the problems that they have in other areas. I'm not qualified.
Thank you.
Any further questions? If not, thank you, Mr. Folstrom. Now there are Mike Dewey. Are you going to take too long?
Very briefly, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mike Dewey, speaking on behalf of the Oregon Wheat Growers League. From an agricultural standpoint, the Oregon Wheat Growers League is opposed to Senate Bill 435. From a seasonal aspect, from a harvest aspect, it would place a real burden from a 9-hour maximum working standpoint. We would hope if the committee, in their wisdom, decides that Senate Bill 435 is needed, that an amendment could be offered to exempt the agricultural situation.
Okay, Phil, if you talk, because you're going to be the third one, I think that Michael McLean with Kent Curley's Dairy, did you have something you wanted to say, Mr. McLean?
Yes, I did.
Let's let Mr. McLean come up here then. Ed, do you want to say anything?
Well, I'm Phil Goulet, and representing Oregon Farm Bureau and Oregon Hop Growers, and I'll just concur with Mike pretty much on this. And
farm,
if we
farm
can,
difficulties.
This farm perishability of the crop is our main problem, and weather, which we can't control.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mike McLean.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Michael McLean. I'm employed as a controller for Curley's Dairy, a local organization. We process dairy products, other kindred supplies. As opposed to everyone else that's given testimony, we are unorganized labor. We have approximately 97 employees. We have about 65% of our employees working 4 10-hour days, the remainder working 5 8-hour days. We have an average of 55 hours a month of overtime, and we never, ever have a shortage of people volunteering for it. And the reason we went to 4 10-hour days, we found during the last energy crisis in 72 a necessity to curtail our fuel use. Our fuel use is down some 17%. Our employee morale is up and intrinsic value. Our highway usage and our pollutants dumped upon the Salem airshed is down a minimum of 20%. We're running one day less. We believe that this to be a bargaining issue between outside labor, organized labor, and management. We don't want to address the management labor issue since we're really not involved in that. The one on page three, the one section, section four, deals with injurious to physical health and the well-being of such person and tends to prevent him from acquiring the degree of intelligence that makes him a useful and desirable citizen of the state. As opposed to what may go on and may not go on in other industries, we believe that our people with one extra day off are much more intelligent, have a better attitude, and do definitely perform their duties in a much more satisfactory manner. Management's concurrence with the four 10-hour days was met with a bunch of employees. Employees like this situation, and quite frankly, if we went to it, we would have problems rescheduling.
You heard the problems in the steel industry and with the CWA.
Yes.
You heard that, but would you concur that there is a problem where they are being disciplined when they work 12 hours and 16 hours and when they refuse to take any additional overtime in such instances? Would you treat your employees that way?
No, if an employee doesn't want to work overtime, he won't. We never usually have a shortage of that.
Listen, we have evidence here that in certain industries, it's unfortunate they cause problems for all of them, like the telephone, Pacific Northwest Bell, the nickel plant at Riddle, as well as Watt Chain. Three of them, I think, are the only examples we've had in before this committee. And it's too bad we have to pass a bill and affect all industry because of three industries that are abusing the overtime problem and forcing the employees to work. I don't know if the committee wants to take action on this today or not.
Chairman?
Yeah. Yes.
Well, I think that the only question I would have of this witness would be if he has an amendment which would meet his objection to the Senate Bill 435.
An amendment that we'd suggest would perhaps be the inclusion of four 10-hour days. Now, I don't know. I suppose legislative council could amend that. But I believe there are a number of people in the Salem area who are now experimenting with four 10-hour days. It was recommended by the federal agencies during the energy shortage last winter.
Employees that favor that, like Clackamas County employees work, I think, during the summer 10-hour days. They prefer to have an extra day off. So I'm sure that we can include that. I'd like to see an amendment in to that effect, and I'd like to see this bill. I'd like to see if we could make it apply to Pacific Northwest Bell and those and Hannah Nickel, as well as the steel company, and I think this is where the problems exist, and I think this is going to be very difficult, and I can see where the farmers, the food processors have a problem. I think it's going to be necessary to have a subcommittee. I'd like to have some from labor on there, and I'd like to, I think, Jerry Novak, if you could work on there, if we could come up with a, and we'd like to have our council and maybe Cliff Crow, if you
Chairman.
Could work on with Jerry. Let's get someone from
Memphis.
Yes.
Well, I still think it's a good bill, and I'd be willing to work on establishing some amendments. And I would appreciate being on the subcommittee.
Okay, I'll put you on with our with Senator Wires. Okay. That would be a good combination. You work good together.
I hope you don't turn me
into common cause while you're at it.
No, we'll tell you of all the meetings.
Okay. I won't turn you in.
Mr. Chairman, then it is assume that you will work out an amendment which would include those who are working a 10-hour day.
I'd like to. I can't see penalizing all the industry because of the sins of a few, and I mean sins, you know.
Mr. Chairman, do I understand that Senator Roberts and Wires are on the floor?
I think that they. I think they make a good statement. And I'm not being derogatory, Mary, because of
I
took
that. I don't
on
take
there.
Offense at that, and I'm sure Senator Wires.
I thought you'd be offended because Senator Wires was on there.
No, I thought you'd say that we were going to handle it the way exactly the way you would have handled it.
Okay. And then let's have someone from where's that list? Would Jim Mitchum, would you like to serve on this with them and see if you can? Now we have web agriculture on there.
Oh,
Mike, do it.
No, that's the only copy I have. Hold on.
Mike? Is Mike here?
No.
Well, we'll get some, if he isn't interested, we'll get someone that's good from agriculture. What about you, Mike? Would you like to work with the committee on this?
That would help if I could.
Okay. And I think the staff here, if you get together with staff, they'll work with you and set up a date when the subcommittee can get together. Okay?
Fine. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Let's go to the bill, and I'm sorry to hold. I never realized this bill would take so much time, and we'll go to 791. And there's a number of witnesses here, and if you feel after the first witness has testified that you're being repetitious or you have nothing new to offer what you have, and we'd appreciate it. I think that Les Rawls is here, the insurance commissioner, in favor of the bill, and out of courtesy to Les, then we'll go on with the slides. Les Rawls here, insurance commissioner? I see. Why don't you do your slides here? Okay. Is that your projector there? No.
It'll come out of the board.
And would you give your name for the record?
Yes,
too?
I have a short statement. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Kay Rohn. I am presently employed at the University of Oregon Health Sciences Center as the department head of occupational therapy. I am what is called a registered occupational therapist. This means I attended one of the 49 schools in the nation that offers a bachelor's degree in OT. After the 4 years of college, I had 9 months of supervised internship. I had 3 months in a rehabilitation center, 3 months in a psychiatric center, and 3 months in an acute medical setting. After I had both my schooling and my internship, I took a national registration exam, which when I passed allowed me to call myself registered occupational therapist. Within Oregon, there is not a four-year school or university that offers a degree in occupational therapy, but at Mount Hood Community College, there is a course to become a certified occupational therapy assistant. There are 41 schools in the nation that offer usually a two-year course for people to become certified occupational therapy assistants. Presently, there are approximately 23,000 registered occupational therapists, certified occupational therapy assistants and students in the nation. Approximately 300 of these are in Oregon. To protect the public, we have tried through our national association, the American Occupational Therapy Association, to develop and maintain standards of education, practice, and training. And in the past, this has worked quite well, as most occupational therapists have voluntarily chose to be members and become registered through our national exam. Lately, we've come to realize that our clients do have a potential of harm being done to them by individuals who have little or no training that hold themselves out as qualified occupational therapists. The American Occupational Therapy Association has no effective enforcement or legal ability to prevent the unqualified from attempting to practice occupational therapy. So it's only been in the last few years that nationwide we have gone for state licensure as a means to protect our clients. There are presently six states that have licensed occupational therapists: Florida, Ohio, Arkansas, Georgia, Utah, and New York. Bills have been filed in 10 other states, including the District of Columbia and Oregon. Within Oregon, our need to seek licensure to protect our consumers has been supported by what I hope you have received as a support packet of letters from professionals and our clients. The licensing of occupational therapists in the six states has not increased the cost of occupational therapy. Within Oregon now, the salaries for occupational therapists and physical therapists are the same within their respective institutions. And even though the physical therapists are licensed, usually the fee for service is comparative between the departments. So at the University of Oregon Health Sciences Center, a similar half-hour individual treatment in both physical therapy and occupational therapy is the same at about $14 a half an hour. We do not expect or desire that licensing will increase our own salaries or the fee to our clients. So I do have some slides to show you some occupational therapy services to people in Oregon. These slides were provided by the Visiting Nurse Association of Portland, Providence Hospital, Emmanuel Hospital, the University of Oregon Health Sciences Center, Crippled Children's and Holiday School Occupational Therapy Department.
Would you answer one question? Why would the Oregon Association of Hospitals, why would they be opposing this bill if it didn't cost them a few nickels more? I see they're the only opponent that you have.
I think they just have kind of a set standard to be against licensing boards. We realize ourselves there's pros and cons to licensing, and
no,
sometimes it's been abused.
So that isn't too shabby.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Rawls is here. Would you like to hear him?
Do you want me to show the slides and then have Commissioner Rawls? Because
yes.
He is here.
Less, unless you want to be the star and go on first.
No, I wait. I'd like to see the movie.
It'll take about 10 minutes, and I will go as fast as possible.
Can you do that without a light?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. Occupational therapy is concerned with individuals and activity. In the broad sense of the word, occupation refers to absolutely anything we do, from sleeping and eating to working and playing, learning and growing. Occupational therapists use activity as the media through which they treat their clients in such settings as hospitals, schools, work training centers, community programs such as alcohol or drug abuse, long-term care facilities, or I had just become involved in the licensure effort in the last couple of years because of a couple of experiences with my own particular patients. I had one young man at the University of Oregon Health Sciences Center who was a quadriplegic, 16 years old, essentially paralyzed from the neck down. And he was in the hospital about a year because of medical and surgical problems. And in that time, we were able to get him to use the special devices like the ball bearing feeders, and he was feeding himself. When he was being discharged, we had asked a social worker to find a nursing home that had occupational therapy because I felt he could still improve but not stay in the hospital for as long as it was going to take. And was informed that, yes, we found a nursing home and things were all set up. So when I went with him to the nursing home, I found out that their, quote, occupational therapist was a high school graduate doing arts and crafts, had no idea what quadriplegia was or what any of the special devices were. And this young man did not continue on the program that I had set up with him, and I feel that was a detriment to his progress. Another example is just happening this week with an inpatient at the hospital who has a very serious brain tumor, and he's on our rehab unit so that as soon as possible we can get him independent enough to go home for as much time as he has left rather than going to a nursing home. And the wife was very upset to find out that the insurance companies would not pay for the inpatient occupational therapy services. And I think Lester Rawls will address that problem with you, too. Can I answer any questions?
Sure.
Yes, Senator Roberts.
Could you explain for us the difference between an occupational therapist and a physical therapist?
I think some other people will give their examples, too. It depends on our situations quite often. Let me give a couple examples in my particular situation. Someone that's had a stroke and is paralyzed on one side of their body, the physical therapist will be working on balance activities in my place and like walking activities. The balance activities are important in them being able to dress themselves So I need to have the therapist working on those activities so then I can start the person being able to dress usually one-handed. When I have a patient that has a hand injury, such as a scar that's causing a contraction of the hand, the patient will often go to physical therapy and have whirlpool and massage to start loosening the hand up and getting it to work again. Then the patient will come to occupational therapy and work on activities using the hand for the coordination that we need. Or we might also construct a splint. So when they're not using their hand is kept in a position that's very close to the way we want them to be able to use it. That's some of my examples.
Do you have areas of overlap at all?
I'm sure there are. In our particular situation, we don't. With physically handicapped people in the hospital situation, we are working toward the good of the patient, and we have kind of little areas, but we communicate very greatly because we have to. And so I couldn't work without a physical therapist, and I don't think they could work without us. Does that help?
Further questions? Senator Trow?
Perhaps you've said this before, but maybe you could reemphasize it. What are the problems out there that you think licensure would help solve?
Okay. As I kind of mentioned before, we voluntarily have been trying to set standards of practice for our own profession. And that is fine as long as everybody does that voluntarily. But even within our profession, I think there are people where we'd like them to feel the need to stay current, because things in any medical profession are changing so quickly that we have no legal way of saying, you know, you have to attend at least some in-services to try to maintain your professional level of practice. I think the other major problem is just people that think occupational therapy is probably just arts and crafts and that's all you have to know. But with some of the very specialized techniques of neurology and developmental disabilities that we have to know, we have to have that background, that when people call themselves occupational therapists and can't deliver the service that the patient needs, I think that's hurting our people.
I notice now in the bill you're going to grandfather a whole group of people in to
we really don't have
let me finish the question.
Okay, I'm sorry.
And that being the case, what are you going to expect them to do to stay current and to keep themselves in a situation where they can remain licensed?
To keep everybody current, I think it's going to be through continuing education. And we see a need for that, especially for our therapists that are like out in La Grande, Oregon, one therapist who can't get into the metropolitan area for some of our continuing education. So we're trying to set up a system of a tape library for people to have access to in-services and things. There are other courses available at other colleges that we have been setting up in the last year that even though we don't have an occupational therapy school in the state, we are working toward courses that will be available and help us work with our clients.
Any further questions? If not, thank you.
Thank you.
We're indeed privileged to have with us today Lester Rawls, the insurance company commissioner of the state of Oregon.
Insurance company commissioner?
The insurance commissioner.
Contestable. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me to be heard. I know you have a number of people that want to be heard on this bill. I thought that I would give the committee the benefit of some background information that we have with regards to the bill and the need for licensing with regards to the insurance companies. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners have had under study the problem of occupational therapy and its payment under the insurance policies for some time. We have in our comprehensive health bill payment for physical therapists, but not occupational therapists. In our recent meeting in Phoenix, there was a great deal of discussion, and the NAIC made a resolution that we would support licensing of occupational therapy for the purposes of making certain that the payments for this type of care would be paid for under a person's insurance policy. I think the young lady pointed out one of the problems in the company's understanding who in fact was an occupational therapist in the person who was merely giving arts and crafts as opposed to a person who really was doing the job that is like the physical therapist. Now,
Senator Trow asked the same question I asked, or Senator Roberts also, what's the difference between a physical therapist and a occupational therapist? And they, I thought they were one and the same, but we were explained that the meeting, the difference, and I think I understand the difference, but the insurance companies have the same feeling. Most physical therapists are licensed by most states, and they have no problem in paying that. But they do have a problem in this, because many, many people call themselves an occupational therapist. They can be anything. So the companies have agreed that in any case that a person is licensed as an occupational therapist, there would be no problem in making payment the same as a physical therapist. And that's the understanding we have with the NAIC and the major medical carriers. The young lady pointed out one company here who is not making that payment. I think Mr. Fleischner will tell you that the Blue Cross and some of those that in-hospital problems are, there is no problem. The companies are recognizing that. We understand nationwide there is even some difficulty with some of the other companies other than Blue Cross in making payments to so-called occupational therapists because of a misunderstanding as to their credibility. And it seems that the only way that they can really resolve that would be to have a bill which would license though recognized by the state as a type of person equal to a physical therapist. And that's the information I think you ought to have in knowing one of the reasons why, a very important reason, I think, to the people of the state of Oregon, because they're just denied the payment on this coverage. Some of those we can resolve in our office, but as you all know, we only see about one out of every 10 persons who has a problem with their policy, so there's the other nine that just don't get paid.
Thank you, Les. Are there any questions of our commissioner? Not, thank you very much. Now we have numerous witnesses here. Now we have next Bill Casey with OTR, Occupational Therapy. What's R stand for?
Registered.
Okay.
Can we have Dr. Cross?
Yes, Doctor, do you care to come up? And we hope we can speed this up, and we may be able to take action on it today.
Let's just hear the agains and then...
Members of the committee, my name is Bill Casey. I'm a registered occupational therapist with a basic master's degree in occupational therapy from Western Michigan University. I work as a staff therapist with four other registered OTRs and two certified occupational therapy assistants in a rehabilitation hospital of 30 inpatient beds and outpatient facilities named the Rehabilitation Institute of Oregon, a division of Good Samaritan Hospital and Medical Center in Portland. As the pamphlet explains, the yellow pamphlet which you've received, I'm a member of one of three teams of professionals, including a physiatrist, a rehabilitation nurse, a physical therapist, a psychologist, a speech pathologist. And of these that I've mentioned, I'm the only professional not licensed by the state of Oregon to practice. I evaluate in my job the physical status and potential of the patients I see assigned to my team. I plan a program of training these individuals to do the necessities of independent living. People say occupational therapists train giving people occupations. Well, the occupations that we see as reachable for our patients are feeding themselves, dressing themselves, washing themselves, sometimes preparing their own food, sometimes using a toilet and a bathtub by themselves. But for the most part, the people I'm seeing are wheelchair-bound for life. I provide special activities for improving their strength, coordination, other physical abilities necessary to accomplish these things, these basic occupations, and I also fabricate, obtain, or suggest special equipment to use in accomplishing these tasks. Last year, we at Rio saw 93 persons as inpatients who have permanently lost the use of all or almost all of their limbs, and about 50% of these were under the age of 25. Most of these were victims of motor vehicle accidents within the state, resulting in damage to their spinal cord, and there's more sophisticated medical equipment, including CPR, medical technicians, and so forth, become available to these people to maintain their vital body functions and systems immediately following injury. We expect to see patients with higher cord injuries. In other words, the cervical spinal cord will be damaged at a higher level, resulting in less function of the arm and no function in the legs in the trunk. I've drawn up a chart which you see, and this lists the injuries, the muscles that are left intact, and what functional goals that we and PTs in my profession seek to attain. And you might notice it might be a little bit more visual explanation of what PT and OT does in my setting and how we do cross functions sometimes. This is part of a team effort, and yet each are responsible with end goals that are a little bit different. We see the end goal, for instance, as feeding or training, but we may be providing some exercise or something like that which we feel is more important to the patient at the time. An untrained or unscrupulous, and I put this in quote, occupational therapist, working with the type of patient that I do could very likely neglect certain muscles in the patient's reconditioning through improper exercise, allow possible contractures to develop as in the web space of the thumb, causing the thumb to be held in as such. And I oftentimes will see this in a hospital setting where the PT has enough time trying to keep contractures from developing in the legs. And oftentimes, because of the number of patients they have to see and the time they can spend with the patient, they can't exercise the thumb. Later on, it's important so that they have grasp. And also, I think it's important that a therapist understand what the goals of a patient are with a certain level of injury. My training has been in thoroughly neurology, kinesiology. We have the same training as a physical therapist, the same number of years in school and so forth. In addition, the average cost for the initial year of medical expense to the spinal cord injured patient is between $40,000 to $50,000 nationally now. And he often ends up on welfare by the end of the rehabilitation stay at our hospital. Much valuable time is spent, and often fruitlessly, by the occupational therapist and by the staff to convince welfare to pay for such special items such as swivel spoons, typing sticks, thumb splints, things that they need to do essentials in life, not frivolities. And in our hospital, licensure of OTs, I feel, would assist us in becoming as reputable as the physical therapist. The physical therapist often has less trouble finding funding for a wheelchair, whereas presently, it's almost impossible to get Medicare to pay for some of the adaptive devices that we use. In my thinking, what can a person do once he learns how to ambulate or walk before he can get dressed? Last year, occupational therapists at Rio saw 49 inpatient cases of brain damage from around this and other states. The majority of these, again, from motor vehicle accidents. Numerous others were admitted as inpatients for such things as evaluation for workman's compensation, training in the use of artificial arms due to amputation, physical rehabilitation for diagnoses such as multiple sclerosis, stroke, amputation, cerebral palsy, and other crippling causes. I feel these patients don't need further advice from the individuals who call themselves therapists, quote-unquote, and yet have nothing useful to offer the patient. And I think, as Mr. Rawls pointed out, there are people around that do that. On the other hand, if intervention by a licensed OT is made appropriately, permanent emotional and physical damage can be avoided. And in regard to this payment business, a Corvallis OT just mentioned to me before we started here that a 12-year-old boy she had been seeing after a limb fell on him and caused brain damage, she had been seeing to improve his coordination, asked for repayment from welfare, and the quote from the welfare office down where she was working was that we're not licensed, and because the state law does not allow licensed professionals
to service these people that we cannot be paid. The boy's mother decided that it was worthwhile to pay themselves, so they did. For example, a 19-year-old, and I'd like to mention a case now where serious harm can come, and I think this is pretty crucial. A 19-year-old male that I treated with a diagnosis of brain damage from a car accident was referred to Rio after receiving acute medical care in a rural Oregon community hospital. He received physical therapy, however, an occupational therapist was not employed at the hospital. An orthopedic surgeon consulting on the case prescribed for the patient a splint of this nature. It's called an outrigger active extension splint. The object of this type of splint is to hold the fingers suspended out instead of contracting like this. Ordinarily, it's good with peripheral nerve damage, but when it's a central nerve damage causing a contracture of the hand like this, an increase on the flexor muscles like the rubber band provides causes even more contraction of the hand and can result permanent damage to the hand, permanent contracture, if left on long enough, and would require surgical intervention before anything could be done to actively bring it out again. Now, I'd like to also point out that the occupational therapist could make a splint of this nature, and often does. In this case, the boy's mother told me that the patient was reluctant to hold this on. They had put it on him, and because brain damage patients are often unaware of what's going on, he was fighting it. He was hitting himself in the head with it, contraindications all around. And when I tried to make the basic positioning splint like was seen on the film for the hand, which is a more appropriate type of splint, he would not keep it on for 2 seconds before ripping it off. So what we did was increase, through having him pick up objects and so forth, we increased the hand. It's now back to normal, and he's using it, and he's getting ready to go back into a job now. I'd like to show you another splint, which was made by a registered occupational therapist. This splint was given by a registered occupational therapist to a patient. The patient wore it faithfully. As we all believe, medical people are always the last word in things. For 2 years, the patient's hand now looks like this. It's an improper splint. It should have been remade. The patient should have been reevaluated. He was not. I consider the establishment of a licensing board for members of my profession the first step in presenting minimum standards for this type of an unscrupulous occupational therapist to abide by, as well as suggest methods for improving the dispersal of services. I don't see a board as having to be punitive. I feel that the board should be methods of allowing people to gain licensure too, as well, by suggesting improvement in their abilities. I feel that therapists should be required to provide a licensing board with current lists of the specialty services they can provide, the fees that they charge, and this should be available to all times through a licensing board or through the state organization. Finally, I'd like to stress that while there are many pros and cons in a licensure question, these facts remain. Number one, an occupational therapist is a health practitioner who, unlike many others, can evaluate and treat a patient at his own professional discretion and cognizance without the order of a physician and the guidelines of practice set forth by the American Occupational Therapy Association. I propose that number two, misjudgments and mismanagement on the part of an occupational therapist can, in certain situations, result in a serious physical harm to that client. And three, I propose that the occupational therapist is not yet legally regulated in the state, is only loosely defined as to the role and function in third-party payment for these services, and is performing a major role in rehabilitative medicine, being employed in most major hospitals in this and the other United States. I urge you to support the bill and ensure its enactment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Casey. Are there any questions by any member of the committee? We have Dr. Cross, and I thought you have a number of witnesses here, and I think that we have enough information on this bill, unless the committee feels we shouldn't hear witnesses. There's about 15 other witnesses in favor, and there's only one opponent. But let Dr. Cross, if he has something to say, then we'll call on the only opponent to the bill, Pete Fleischer, with the Oregon Hospitals Association, as soon as we're through. Don't everybody turn around and look at him. He isn't that bad. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Leland Cross, and I'm a physician licensed to practice medicine in the state of Oregon. For the past 10 years, I've been medical director of the Rehabilitation Institute of Oregon, a division of Good Samaritan Hospital and Medical Center in Portland, Oregon. My background in training in medicine has been at Northwestern University in Chicago, where I graduated in 1952, and UCLA, where I received my graduate training in the specialty of physical medicine and rehabilitation in 1963, 4, and 5. In addition to 4 years at each university medical center, I was 10 years in general practice in the Midwest, and then 10 years here in Oregon. In the several of the prior speakers have commented, I will leave my written notes for you to peruse if and as you wish, and comment more directly and perhaps succinctly. I think Mr. Rawl's comments are one of the chief reasons that I feel that licensure is very important in the state of Oregon and in other states as well, but that we're talking about Oregon. The HIPAA department today indicated that with the change from CHAMPUS administration from one group to another this past year, the new group is in New Mexico, but they administer the payment for benefits in the Northwest, I believe Region 10, have denied payments for OT services, which prior they have been paying, and it's based on the fact that there's no licensure in the state. As I traveled around in various states doing accreditation surveys for rehabilitation facilities, which parallels in rehab's programs hospital accreditation, which in hospitals is required to get payment for Medicare, as well as other stipulated interest groups. It's a benchmark or an establishment for hospitals that's important. And in rehab facilities, although it's much more recent, the same program needs are in evidence. I was in one state this past summer. There was no state licensure for one of the disciplines in the rehabilitation service area in speech. In most states, as our own, where there is licensure, some standard is established. The person providing speech in this state was a college graduate with her degree in speech and drama. Has really a little, but not a great deal, to do with clinical speech pathology and the certified master's degree program that is required in Oregon. You asked the question, and I'm not sure, maybe Mr. Fleischer will answer, but I might give you, as a administrator, the first 3 years of the rehabilitation center where I worked prior to its merger with Good Samaritan Hospital, why hospitals, or the Oregon Association of Hospitals, might be against licensure. Well, I could only say in those 3 years that we were not licensed as a general hospital, and we had nothing but difficulty collecting from state-controlled insurance carriers. We were licensed as a special hospital for rehabilitation. The technicality that many of the carriers wiggled out of not paying for our services was that we did not have a surgery, we did not have a vibratory or emergency services. Well, the federal government and Medicare felt that we could contract with the hospital a block away and not duplicate these expensive services. I think that there is another reason, perhaps, that hospitals have felt that organization of any employment group, unions no exception, although this is not a union, it's a professional group, I wonder really if they see it somewhat as a threat to or loss of control from hospitals with an activist group. I don't see it that way myself, but I think the need is really there for licensing, and without it, I think there's no benchmark or standard, there's no control, and we will have needs that are unmet by an important group of our professional trained people. When the services are not provided, there are two or three things happen in my setting in the hospital. That is, many handicapped patients are unnecessarily admitted to nursing homes or other institutions for care at quite a cost. The costs are often a loss of freedom and independence to that individual, and it's financial to society and the individual. The handicapped people are often discharged home from either hospitals or nursing homes, either unprepared to function on their own, or some fail and soon are readmitted, another costly item. Some sustain injuries because it was not known that they would not succeed, and then they are readmitted with a new problem. Now, another look at hospital the Oregon Association of Hospitals attitude may be that this service can be, as some others in hospital, including administration, billed out as another service, so it's covered in other areas or paid for indirectly rather than directly. Although I've looked at it both ways and done both, I think that we ought to call a spade a spade. If the service is needed, we ought to call it what it is and get it paid for. I would like to go on record as urging this committee and the Oregon legislature to back this professional group with equal training and experience, but somewhat allied area to the physical therapist, to endorse licensure, help them become recognized, and endorse their own continuing education control program of their quality service. Thank you.
Are there any questions? I might say, if we went on with all these witnesses today, you're going to lose your bill, because we just don't have the time. We're losing part of the committee now. So you can keep talking, and we can let everybody on if they want to talk. It's all right with me.
Could I move the bill, Mr. Chairman?
Well, we have two opponents. I want to bring them up here. I mean, they're... we have Ted Hughes and Pete Fleischner, and I think we'll bring them up here at the same time. Thank you, Doctor. And we don't want any booing or hissing during the during this testimony.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ted Hughes, representing the Oregon Healthcare Association. If I may just say a few words and then I'll leave, because Mr. Fleischner is going to get into the meat of the operation.
We'll give you a 10-minute head start.
We do not oppose the bill as such, sir. We also use occupational therapists in nursing homes. The only recommendation we would make would be the section that grandfathers all occupational therapists in. If you're going to create a new licensing board, I think it's good public policy not to grandfather anyone, and that would be my only remark.
Okay. Well, we might have some questions to ask you. Pete, do you have any?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Pete Fleischner. I represent the Oregon Association of Hospitals. As a former physical therapist and one who was registered by the American Registry of Physical Therapists, I have perhaps better knowledge of what occupational therapists do than most people. I have great respect for them. I know what they do, and I know they do a lot of good. I fail to see, however, that licensure as a status thing would make any difference in the manner in which they work or their level of competence.
Pete, you heard the testimony of the insurance commissioner a while ago, one
yes,
of their problems. You know,
well,
and you said you have a great deal of competence in them. They're great people, and they do a good. They can't get paid for it if they.
Well,
the only problem.
Senator, I.
As great as you say they are, they ought to be paid for their work, right?
No question in my mind but what they should be paid for their work. I did some checking. As far as inpatient hospital care is provided in the way of occupational therapy, It is always under the direction of a physician. All patients are under the direction of a physician, and the OTs and the PTs work in that manner. There probably isn't the need for licensure from the standpoint of policing in that respect. As to the payment, Medicare and Medicaid and Blue Cross pay for inpatient occupational therapy services without any problem. There may be some third-party payors who do not. I heard of one today. I was not able to contact the company to check it out. There probably are. I wouldn't doubt their word at all in that respect. But I did call St. Vincent's Hospital, and they've had no problem with any third-party payor, which would include the commercial insurance carriers as well as those I mentioned. If it's an inpatient service, it's paid for. My suggestion, Mr. Chairman, is that if it's felt by the committee that the licensure for OTs is necessary, that those who are employed in hospitals where they're under direct supervision be exempt from licensure.
Chairman?
That would seem to me to be the most important place where they should be licensed. Senator Roberts?
Do you then feel opposite of Mr. Hughes on the question of grandfathering?
Well, I think Mr. Hughes was talking about the grandfathering of people who are not otherwise qualified to take the test. In other words, the grandfather clause calls for one who has worked as an occupational therapy assistant for 4 years, I believe, and 6 years or 6 months under the direct supervision of an OT. And I believe that's the clause to which Mr. Hughes referred. My personal feeling would be that there probably needs to be some grandfathering, or there are going to be a lot of people out of work.
Yeah. Senator Trow,
do you think it's a good idea to license PTs?
Senator, PTs are already licensed. Are you asking my personal opinion?
Yeah.
But when I was a member of the American Registry of Physical Therapists, I thought that was the greatest thing in the world because I could move from one state to another and get a job, and I had the highest level of competency at that time established. Now there are 50 different licensure statutes, and I'm not so sure that there's reciprocity among all those states. There may be some with California and Washington and perhaps not other states. No, my personal opinion is that the National Registry, given that it's not diluted, and I think that the OT's registry is not diluted, is the way to go. I'm sure that those sitting behind me would not agree with that, but that's my personal opinion.
Any further questions? If not, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Feeling of Does anyone, I think as far as grandfathering, is there any question in the committee that as far as grandfathering these people in? That was the only point that Ted Hughes brought up. I personally, they have how many 4 years an occupational therapist has 4 years as a apprentice, or what do you?
I believe the grandfather clause calls for 4 years work as an OT assistant, with at least 6 months of that being under the direct supervision of an OT. Is that correct?
Could you explain it? Do you want to explain, I think, either one of you, and what the requisites for under this grandfather clause, who would qualify?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, my name is Sue Nelson from Portland. The grandfather clause will include people who are currently registered occupational therapists within the state of Oregon. These are people who have passed the national registration examination and are now practicing. It will also grandfather in certified occupational therapy assistants who are graduates from the accredited school at Mount Hood Community College and have completed the requirements for the assistance program and have completed the training period following that.
Okay. That's not too I think they had adequate training.
Anybody else?
No, those are the only people. May I also address the former speaker and say that there are a number of occupational therapists working within the state of Oregon that are not employees of hospital settings and are not working under the direct supervision of a physician. Our practice allows us to include settings within community agencies. We do coordinate very closely with medical supervision. Some of the therapists that we're planning to testify here today are in private practice and in community agencies such as myself with the school district. So I think there are a number of us that do not come under the category that the previous speaker has mentioned.
Okay, any further questions? Not, thank you. Okay, what's the pleasure of the committee?
Chairman, I move Senate Bill 791 to the floor of the DuPass recommendation.
Senator Wyers moves Senate Bill 791 to the floor of the DuPass recommendation. The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Roberts?
Aye.
Senator Tro?
Aye.
Senator Wyers?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Motion is carried.
What about this?
We're going to hear Senate Bill 883. And we should be through that shortly. It's a short one. We only got.
They're short of quorum in the other committee.
Well, we got people from the screen
here. Testimony, and it will be okay if Bob Arthur would come forward.
Is that that one?
Yeah. Then I got the barbers. We got the barbers here, too. Did you want to testify on behalf of the barbers?
I'm going to go out and get a haircut.
Okay. Would you go ahead and make your... We've had one hearing on this, and make it as brief as possible, Bob.
It can be very brief, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the simple reason that the previous hearing... the question came up, I think, from Senator Carson that the wording that is in the presentation now of the bill might preclude the other connections such as plumbing, sheet metal, etc., from being done by those particular crafts, etc. So in the meantime, since the last hearing, and I have copies I can give each one of the committee members, I think I have enough, that reworded it. I had an attorney reword it so that, as he says, it would stand up to what it was intended to be. And what it says now, no person is required to obtain a license or label to set in place, listed or labeled, certified electrical, equipment or devices, comma, such as water heaters, furnaces, etc., that require at least one other connection to services and facilities other than electrical, or to make the connection to services and facilities other than electrical. This happened to be part of what was left out, I think, was the last statement that bothered Senator Carson because we may have precluded the plumber from hooking up a water heater.
Could you read that again? After devices such as water heaters, what?
Furnaces, etc. I have copies, okay. Senator Trolla.
Do we put et ceteras in the statutes?
Well, we can take that out. It includes many, many items as reason for the et cetera.
Okay, yeah.
It's an attorney's opinion that we should have something as a for instance.
Okay, really?
To clarify. So, this is what it was supposedly always applied to, and he felt that we should put it in, and we would have no problem then.
Do we have copies of that amendment?
I do. Have you supplied typed copies to the secretary here?
You have them there, but you haven't passed them out as yet, right?
No, I just brought them in case you wanted
them. Okay. I'll tell you what, to speed up this, I think what we're going to have to do is
Les, we have Bob Peterson and Bert Curtwright. Is that right? You're from LeGrand.
Yes.
Why don't you present those amendments, and I'm going to ask you to work with some people here that the other side, the people that are opposed to the bill, and I think we can probably clean it up and make it a good bill, Mr. Arthur. A bill that will be satisfactory. Would you both come up and... Bob Peterson was formerly worked for this committee 4 years ago, and very capable and competent young attorney from LeGrand, now prosperous. And okay, you want to lead off, Bob, or do you, Mr. Furright?
Go ahead. Senator, I'll lead off. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'll be very brief. I haven't seen a copies of the amendments that have been tendered. If there's an extra one, I'd like to take just a brief moment to look at it, if it's all right.
Here. If that is satisfactory, Bob, after taking a look at it, perhaps we can do something on the bill today.
No, it's not satisfactory.
Well, you took you long to make up your mind, didn't you?
Well... If et cetera includes irrigation equipment that Mr. Courtright and other Oregon industries produce, why, then I'd say it would be satisfactory, but I'm sure it doesn't. I'd like to give you, I don't know whether the committee has had the background on this, because unfortunately I was not able to attend the last hearing.
Well, I understand Mr. Courtright's an inventor.
Yes, among other things.
Among other things.
He has a an irrigation... company in LeGrand that produces wheel irrigation systems, circle irrigation systems, and other types of products used by farmers in irrigation. Originally, this bill, or the reasons for this bill, became apparent when a lawsuit was filed by Mr. Courtright against the Department of Commerce. And briefly, the background was that the Department of Commerce said that Mr. Courtright had to have a licensed electrician to hook up cables and motors, and I'll let him explain more about that if the committee's interested. The way these irrigation this irrigation equipment is set up, it's all prepackaged. It's just like a lot of other things that are prepackaged now, and all you have to do is hook wires on with straps, bolt on little motors and other things that he'll explain to you. Now, the Department of Commerce said that even though there was actually no hooking up of live wires, that still should be a licensed electrician performing that work, as well as the trenching and laying the cables in the trenches. Now, I should say right off from the very beginning that any time live wires are hooked up, a licensed electrician performs that work right now. In other words, when they're hooking the system up, he performs that work. He also inspects the work that's been done to date. Now, the main problem with requiring a licensed electrician is that this is a unique operation. It is not only has principles of that are, most electricians are familiar with, but it also covers a lot of other things. For instance, radio communications and a lot of things electricians, most electricians, aren't familiar with. So really what you're doing is putting two requirements, or an additional requirement, is not necessary. In order for Mr. Courtright to sell this, these wheels and these lines with a warranty, it has to be put into the manufacturer's specifications. If it's not, then it's not under warranty. The only way he can do that is if he has factory-trained people doing the actual installation. And that's why, for several other reasons, but that's one of the main reasons that we don't think that this bill is a good bill. We think all it does is add another another inspection service in the name of safety, when actually it isn't necessary. Now, the main thing, of course, is the cost. And this is a very important factor, particularly now when... it's an absolute necessity in Eastern Oregon to have irrigation systems. particularly the last 2 years, it's become more and more evident that it's going to be a thing that's going to have to be used in the future more and more, because the water has to be spread out and utilized more efficiently. And these type of irrigation systems do it. And right now the farmers have had such a terrible time the last 2 years that by making the additional expense, and nobody really knows what it would cost, because there hasn't been licensed electricians doing this work in the past, so we don't know how long it would take them even. We don't even know if the people are available to do it. So I think that the only way this bill could be cleaned up so that it would be acceptable to the people who manufacture and install irrigation devices would be to have an exclusion dealing specifically with irrigation equipment, or to put the whole thing under the Department of Agriculture, where farmers are familiar with dealing with it and where I feel they could handle the problem if there is a problem. So far, nobody's, we don't know what a problem is, if a problem exists even. We've never been told about it. And I think Mr. Court right now should elaborate a little bit on just exactly how these things are put together and packaged so that the committee will understand why what the Department of Commerce is trying to do here is completely unnecessary.
I might say before we do that, for the record, I've appointed Michael McLean with the Steelworkers and Linda Rassman with CWA also to the subcommittee on Senate Bill 435.
Yes, it might be well for me to kind of review how I got into this. Several years ago, I bought a franchise to sell Valmont circles. They were built in Valley, Nebraska by Valmont Industries and Valmont...
Mic up a little closer.
Yeah. Valmont Industries was the originator of the circle irrigation system. And one of the requirements of the franchise was that we have factory-trained personnel, you know, installing the machines. Now, part of this is because that there are a lot of micro-switches and electronics involved in these machines. They have an elaborate corner system that you maybe have heard about that reaches out and catches a corner, makes a square circle out of a circle. And they have electronic devices on them. They have radio controls, they have tone signal devices, and all kinds of things that really a licensed electrician is not qualified to handle. And so one of the requirements was that we have factory-trained personnel, which meant that we had to send our people, the key people who were going to work in this, back to the factory for 2-week periods 4 times last year. It cost a minimum of $2,500 per person to do this. All right. But in the meantime, right after I got this, I sold some systems, and the factory recommended that I contract some contract crews out of Nebraska, which were factory trained people, and asked them to assemble the machines. Now, there again, these people were asked to do only those things necessary to put them erect and have them ready for a licensed electrician to complete. In other words, we were still required to have a licensed electrician make all the final connections and inspections. Well, in the process of doing this, we did hire the contract crews, and we were shut down by the local electrical inspector. He put a red tag on things. We got into quite an altercation with our customer because it was held up for 2 weeks, and in the meantime, his crop burned, and he wanted to sue us, and so on. It got pretty sticky. I had read this section of the law. I didn't see where we were infringing upon the law in any way, shape, or form, but we were assured time and again that we were, and that there was a rule against it. So we eventually took it to court, and we found out that we were right. The law was specific, and it was an excellent law. It covered our needs. It covered the needs of the farmer. Now, safety has nothing to do with this, as far as we're concerned, because we still have to live within the national code. We still have to live under the jurisdiction and under the inspection of the inspection division, electrical inspection division. So it isn't a matter of safety. It's a matter that is money and time, and is also has quite a great deal to do with the expertise needed to get the things together the way the factory demands. Now, the factory makes demands upon us much worse than Electrical Inspection Division does. They demand that we do things in certain prescribed manners. None of those things are in conflict with the National Code or with the Oregon Code. But they go quite a little further. And they say that they will not warranty the machines unless we have done these specific things. We have found that it's next to impossible to get an electrical contractor to do these things. And so what we do is we put our people in the field with electrical people, a licensed electrician. And therefore we have a duplication of effort, and our people then have to show the licensed electrician what to do and how to do it, what connections to make and what not to do, and so on. It becomes very burdensome for everybody. The law as it is a good law. It's a very just law and a very fair law, and it covers the situation very nicely. Thank you.
Is that it?
Well, the only thing that I was hoping to expand on a little bit, because I can't, I don't have enough expertise to describe how these things are packaged, but I think it's important for the committee to realize that this is no different than installing a water heater in a house. There's a lot less danger because you don't have consumers around. It's out in the middle of a field. You know, if you're going to apply it to an irrigation device, then why shouldn't it be applied likewise to a water heater or to mobile homes or to modular homes that are built? In other words, the way the law was originally before this amendment was offered, you couldn't build a mobile home in the state of Oregon without having an electrical inspector there all the time, a licensed electrician to hook it up. Under this, now, under these proposed amendments, I assume that that's one of the things they're trying to correct. But they've got water heaters and furnaces, and I would certainly think that there's more danger. If you're talking about safety, you're going to find more instances where if you have an untrained worker down at Terry Traders, for instance, in LeGrand, or any of the other mobile home outfits around Portland, installing water heaters, there's the potential for danger is a lot greater there than it is with a circular irrigation system that's prepackaged, and all you do is put certain bolts and so on.
What I'm going to do is that I think that the committee's problem is concerned about your problem up there in Eastern Oregon. I'd like to have a subcommittee work on this, and I would appoint Senator Carson and Senator Jernstedt and Dave Nelson, who represents the farmers, and also Mr. Arthur, Bob Arthur. Perhaps you could have some amendments drafted which would take care of this problem up there in the meantime, Mr. Arthur. You suppose?
Right.
Okay, and this is a problem you wanted to solve, and that's reading out that legislation because you lost your case. Peter?
The reason is tremendous, but in the case is too broad now, it covers everything.
Yeah. Well, if you can narrow it down, I can see where there are problems up there that it's difficult to even find a qualified electrician in many instances, and these factory-trained people that are trained to handle this situation, why, I would hope that you could work out something with them. Okay.
Thank you, Senator.
And if you would call, if you can get Senator Carson and notify them. Last but not least are the four barbers. We've been kicking them around all session, Senator Trove, and
we have.
And where's the sign up on that bill?
You had it right there.
2093. Okay, let's have Bob Hansen, whatever against. Let's have Ron Freeman. Parnell Pearson. Tom Bender, let's have them all up here. Let me have two of them up here at a time. Reverend Patterson, you and Tom Fender working together on this?
Tom Fender?
Okay, why don't you come up, Glenn? Would you like to lead off, and you can probably lead us in a brief word of prayer, too, because we have some here that need it.
I'd be glad to do that.
I know you would. Okay, and are you Parnell?
No, I'm Ron Freeman.
Freeman. You're a self-barber, and you're an Adventist barber, are you,
right,
too?
Uh-huh.
And you're an Adventist barber. Okay. You're speaking in their behalf, Glenn?
Right, I have prepared testimony. I think all you right. have it there. Honorable Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I am Glenn E. Patterson of the Seventh-day Adventist Church Northwest Headquarters, Department of Public Affairs. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in favor of House Bill 2093, which would repeal the only Sunday law still on the Oregon law books. This vestige of the ancient blue laws should have been repealed long ago. It prohibits barbering on Sunday, yet it is perfectly legal for the cosmetologist to cut women's hair on Sunday in the beauty shops. This is a very discriminating law. The barber profession is the only profession in Oregon discriminated against in the operation of business. My work covers the five Northwest states, and Oregon is the only one with a law restricting barbers on Sunday. In checking these states regarding whether or not barber shops are open on Sunday, we could find none open in Alaska, Idaho, or Montana. Washington State repealed its Sunday blue laws by initiative in 1966 by a vote of the people. According to our check, there are only four shops open on Sunday in Washington, even though there is no legal restriction. In fact, I'll point out that's the only barber shops in the whole Northwest. There is no reason to believe that Oregon will alter its pattern of barbershop hours any more than have other Northwest states. In 1975, the Oregon legislature repealed the Sunday law governing pawnbrokers. And in 1977, the legislature should repeal the last Sunday law on our books, which restricts the barbers, and thus we will, we'll end this unjust discrimination. The principles of freedom of choice and the free enterprise system should be practiced in Oregon also. The House passed HB 2093 overwhelmingly, and we encourage the Senate to do the same.
Okay, any questions? Glenn, this is supported by the Adventist Church, and what is the reason? I mean, what's this got to do with, if Saturday was the accepted day of worship, if we were to close and you had barbers, barbershops were required to close on Saturday. Would you still be in favor? Would your church support barbershops staying open on Saturday?
Let me say that Christianity Today, Protestant, not a Seventh-day Adventist publication, recently came out with a suggestion that they close down many things on Saturday rather than the previous legislation on Sunday, and we from our headquarters opposed that and said we do not believe that anyone should do that.
Church is becoming terribly modernistic, are they not, Glenn?
Churches are. I have something rather interesting here, a 1978 calendar that says each of the 7 days of the week is designated as the Sabbath by various nationalities and religions. Monday is the Greek Sabbath, Tuesday the Persian, Wednesday the Assyrians, Thursday the Egyptians, Friday the Turkish, Saturday the Jewish, and Sunday the Christian. So if you want to close them down, we'll close them down every day of the week.
We don't have too many Turks over here, though.
Or Assyrians.
Or Assyrians. Quite a few Adventists. Any further questions, Cliff? Do you have any
Question? No, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, might I say this is not because we're Seventh-day Adventists. We think the principle is all wrong, and I'd be here fighting just as hard if you tried to close them down on Saturday.
You won't come in with a Saturday closure bill next session, then?
No, sir.
Okay. You two, do you have anything to add to that? Okay. Yeah.
There is, as I went through it, going through apprenticeship and...
Are you a Ross?
I'm Parnell Person from Albany, Oregon.
Parnell Person, okay.
As I went through the apprenticeship and so on, and I know that there are other people of my own denomination and of other denominations who have shunned going into this because of the fact that it leaves you 3 days without being able to work. And I had quite a time going through this and had to move my family and practically lost my home and so on and so forth to be able to finish my apprenticeship once I got started.
Excuse me. Are you going to... Okay. He's good. Go ahead.
So, other than religious-wise, it does work quite a hardship. And... I think, in fairness, I'm with Glenn. I don't want to see any laws closing anything on any day. I think it should be absolutely your own personal choice if you want to close your business on a Monday or a Tuesday or a Wednesday.
Or if an Adventist wants to work on Saturday or Friday night, whatever he wants to do.
Anything he wants to, really.
I think that's good. If they want to smoke, it's all right. Their church doesn't criticize them then.
What now?
They can do if they want to smoke or drink. They, as far as the church is concerned, it's okay with them, and they want to.
Our church.
They want to work on Saturday. It's all right.
Our church has its own doctrines. Of course, this has to be held up.
This fall?
This is still the individual's choice if he wants to go along with it or not.
Whatever he
wants.
Whether
he wants to be a member or not.
Okay. Thank you. Bob Hansen and Dan Block with the Oregon State, Bob is with the Oregon State Barbers and Beauticians Association, and Dan Block with the Board of Barbers and Examiners.
Okay.
Bob Hansen, do you want to lead off?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senators, I represent the Oregon State Barbers and Beauticians Association, which is organized labor in the state for barbers and beauticians, and... I want to say that now, when this bill started and it was first thought up, it was in the interim committee in Labor and Commerce, and it had two other very important items in it, we thought. Now, when it got to the House, it came out with just the Sunday closing, which I'm not going to stand up here and fight about, even though personally I like to see it, but I'm not going to make a big issue on that. What we would like to do is see the original bill form adopted here. And if you have that, you all it does is grant us some of the things that we're already doing in barbering. And the original bill on line 18, it's on page 2, first, the only page, and you got that? It says, waving or relaxing the hair. What we did, we took out of male persons only, added relaxing, which is something we do, as well as waving, and it doesn't appear in our law. And we took out of male persons only because that is highly questionable there, because if you do it on one, it's naturally assumed you can do it on the other. So we think that was a good section of the bill, and we'd like to retain that.
Would you leave GN servicing or selling hair replacements?
Pardon?
Would you leave GN?
Yes, that's hair just going into that. We would leave 18 and 19 in, which was the original bill, which we had really no quarrel with when it came out of the Labor and Commerce Committee, the interim committee.
Why did they gut it? Why did they do that? Why did they take it out?
Senator, I really couldn't tell you why they took it out. I think it was a good bill. I think they thought that we didn't need it, but we do it, and we think it should stay in there because we do. It's nothing that that nobody could, I think, hold against us for any reason, and I think it's a good section of the original bill. We should have it.
If you say you're already doing it, and it's not illegal, what you're already
well,
doing
I, it doesn't. It doesn't stipulate. We've been doing it. I think you all know that barbers have been selling hair pieces and servicing them for years. Since we do it, we'd like to see it in our law. The cosmetic therapists do have it in their law. And I think it's important that we have it in ours, too.
How do you relax hair, Bob?
Well, it's a solution you put on, and it's almost as about as strong as lye. You got to be careful, and it is done, and not in a great amount, but it is. And if you follow the directions on the label, you generally will be all right as long as you're careful.
Dan, you have anything to add?
Mr. Chairman, my name's Daniel R. Block. I'd just like to read a few sentences into the record. I represent the Board of Barber Examiners. I'm the Executive Secretary to the Board. I'm here to testify against House Bill 2893 in the present form. This bill originally was prepared in the Legislative Joint Interim Committee on Labor and Commerce. House Bill 2093 was the resulting omnibus bill on barbering. The House Consumer and Business Affairs amended the original bill and deleted everything except repealing the Sunday closure law. I am not here to address the Sunday closure law in any way, but I am here to see if this committee would restore the bill to the original form, especially the part on page 2, line 18 of the original bill.
This came out of the Committee on Labor, didn't
it? Yes, it did.
And we came That's out right. just as it is here.
Yes, it's original.
And they lifted it and put in...
They just did away with the Sunday closing.
There was nobody testified against this bill on the House side. Then they pulled the first section out of it. Barbers feel that if they may legally waive hair, male hair, using the same solution and procedures used on female hair, that the possibility exists that a discrimination exists similar to the period of time when beauticians could not cut any male hair over the age of 12 years old. And beyond that, that's my testimony.
With Sunday closure, as far as I'm concerned, I'm willing to see that that material is restored. And I was on that particular interview.
Yeah.
Interim committee, and
that's all we're asking for.
Might I say one thing on Sunday closure? Of course, organized, it's not going to be a real big problem for us. We'll be able to live with it because we can work it into our contract. The ones that it will probably affect would be the some people that are small and don't have any organization, but we'll definitely be able to live with it.
Mr. Persons, do you belong to the union, either one of you there? You're independent.
I might stay along that line. We just heard of mandatory overtime in other areas. Well, this could be the same thing again it was prior to 1896 when they worked 12, 14 hours a day, 7 days a week. But beyond that, I don't want to address it.
Okay. Well, let's have this at a work session, as soon as we can. We ought to get back to the House because we'll see if we can't get them to concur with us. Anything further? Oh, Tom Fender wanted to testify on this bill.
Thank you.
We don't want those because wait a minute. That 791 is.
That was a therapy.
I've got somebody
up
there.
Okay. Tom and Bill, what's that? You have no objection. Okay, the Adventist, are you lobbying for the Adventist or hired by the Adventist to lobby on this bill?
Not yet, Senator.
Oh, I just wondered. Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Fender, and with me today is Wayne Bienert, and we're representing the Professional Hair Industry Association. We have no quarrel with any of the previous testimony given on this bill, except I would ask that the committee staff give some consideration to the re-inclusion of line 19. and that would be the servicing or selling of hair replacements. This would be the only place in ORS where this particular provision would appear. It would become an act of barbering, and I think as such might have the effect of statutorily by inference saying that this was an act of barbering and prohibiting the sale of hair pieces by other people who now sell them.
In other words, that's the only line 19 is all you want deleted?
Well, we would suggest that perhaps your staff take a look at some alternative language and not make that necessarily an act of barbering.
Why don't you work with staff and Bob Hansen and see if you can, or and see if you can come up with a yes.
Mr. Chairman, there is wording that would take care of the mutation law. All we'd have to do is take out an inclusion there.
Okay, why don't you work out an amendment, Tom, with right after the meeting here today with Mr. Block and Mr. Hansen. They're both very reasonable people, I found them to be, except they're even agreeing to Sunday closing. You know, I mean, Sunday opening, I mean.
It paid to pray for
him, yeah, you know. But who's praying for you now?
I
am. Do you have anything further,
no.
Tom?
Thank you, Mr.
Let's get together and this next, when we have a work session on this, see if we can't reinstate that material and accept line 19. Work on line 19. And
just to substitute line 19 would be
okay.
Fine.
No problem.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. With that, we are adjourned.